Greetings from Polymancer. Welcome to episode 3 of the Dicecast, Polymancer Studios' official podcast.
Episode 3, The Form of Role-Playing Games and a Review of Fantasycraft. Yeah!
In this issue of Dicecast, we'll be looking at RPGs and RPG trends, where are role-playing games going and what's happening with them. We'll try to not rehash what's been discussed on forums such as RPGNet. Obviously, a lot of people out there have various opinions about what's happening, where the industry is going. Don't worry, this is not going to be a where the industry is going type of thing. It's more a discussion of what the form that our role-playing games are taking these days. And especially we're going to be discussing about things like the role-playing games versions of Dungeons & Dragons from 2nd to 3rd to 3.5 to now 4th edition. Obviously, another big hot topic right now is the new edition of Warhammer, where Warhammer Fantasy, where is it going? And later in the podcast, we'll be doing a quick review of Fantasycraft, the new incarnation of the fantasy role-playing game D20 OGL, I believe, released by Crafty Games, who makes Spycraft, which is going to be very interesting to look at later in the podcast. So first of all, I guess we can just like start talking about where did RPGs come from? Where are they going from now?
Yep, right after this.
Come listen to WapCaplets at WapCaplets.net, a gaming podcast where you're in and out in 5 minutes.
This is Carpetcast, the Gnome Barbarian. Or at least I was until 4th edition came along. And now there's no more gnome playable characters. And there's no more barbarian playable characters. So I'm sticking with the 3.5 set of rules, thank you very much. And that's why I listen to 3.5's Private Sanctuary. Available at www.35privatesanctuary.com.
First indication that we had that RPGs are changing in their various form happened last June 2008, when D&D 4th Ed came out, because one of the most jarring differences between 4th Ed and 3.5 and 3.0 and other editions before it is that miniatures were no longer a really cool thing that you would use with the game to enhance the combat experience. They're now required, right?
Okay, well, when you say require, what do you mean by that?
It is impossible to have combat in the game without using miniatures, because everything is expressed in squares, and just about every move you can make, every effect that the character can have, is expressed in how many squares away you can do this, how many squares you can move, what the range is, what the area effect is. It is impossible to do combat all in your head, like so many people have been doing with RPGs for decades.
So essentially, like, the rules basically tell you this is good for X many squares, or this range is X many square, and basically, unless you're using minis, and obviously, I guess, the square grids that go with them, mm-hmm. There's pretty much no way of running a combat effectively unless you're willing to do away with the rules, at which point you're not even playing the system anymore. Is that correct?
Yeah, no, that's it exactly. You need to have the square grid. Now, there was a review of D&D 4th in Volume 2, Issue 8 of Polymancer magazine, where the reviewer said that the good news is you can get a checkerboard at the dollar store. So you don't need to buy, like, a huge battle mat. But still, if you've never played RPGs with minis before, if you're not a minis type of person, D&D 4th Ed is going to be a transition for you.
Now, I know we said earlier in the intro that we weren't going to do this, but I guess we are going to do that now. A lot of people on forums have mentioned that maybe this move towards a minis intensive game was just basically an idea for, well, basically they want to sell more plastic minis. Is that what people are thinking? Is that what people are seeing? Is it working, first of all? Are people buying more? I mean, obviously, if I want to run a dungeon and I want to have a mini for every monster out there, I'd go broke, you know?
Well, this is absolutely true. I mean, like, Wizards of the Coast are putting out their own line of D&D minis, which they've completely done away with the Dungeons & Dragons miniatures game and are simply making the minis now strictly for use with 4th Ed.
Okay, so basically, like, when you're saying the minis game, for people who might not know, it's like the booster packs and everything, like the collectible miniature games that they had out there.
Yeah, there was a Dungeons & Dragons miniatures game up to a year ago, and now it's strictly D&D minis are simply being made so you can play 4th Ed with them. Now, those are pretty good. You know, anybody who's ever been in the miniatures hobby knows it can be very expensive. You don't have to use those, though, of course. You could always use coins, beads, poker chips.
Yeah, but if you're going to play, like, a combat with miniatures, you don't want to have, like, okay, well, you can move your little Monopoly guy over there and then fight the big, you know, melon hat there. And, yeah, so I can see how you can use the minis. It's kind of interesting, though, that how that now everything is more centered in minis, that they're all plastic, I take it, right? And in the early days of the hobby, you'd actually have pewter minis or lead minis.
Well, we are getting a little bit off topic here. First of all, they're not made with lead anymore. At least most people don't make them with lead anymore. They make them with white metal, which is a alloy of tin and something else, usually an amount of copper in there as a stiffening agent. But it's not toxic. Most miniatures are made of white metal these days, quite frankly. These are the people who do the sculpting and the smelting in their garage, basically, as a cottage-type industry. And there are hundreds, if not thousands, of such manufacturers. Plastic minis are always made by bigger companies that have more money, because in order to make plastic minis, you need a high-pressure injection mold, which costs a bare minimum of $50,000 to make. However, the price per unit in the store is going to be much less.
And hence, going back to our discussion about how minis intensive the new game is, I guess it's basically, okay, let's sell some plastic figures.
I wouldn't call D&D 4th Ed a conspiracy to sell minis. Though certainly that is a happy effect for anybody who makes fantasy miniatures these days. I will say, though, that it is a way to make the game more tactile and more tactical. By tactile, I mean it has more interaction with stuff on the table that you touch, and more tactical, which means tactical, and away from a more cerebral form of role-playing, where all the action was in your head, all of it was in your mind.
Yeah, well, it's kind of interesting, too, that with all the additions of Dungeons & Dragons, and obviously for the people that are listening in the podcast right now, we're not actually singling out the game just to bash or whatever. It's just like for the sake of discussion here. But when Gary Gygax put the first edition of Dungeons & Dragons, he built it as a, and I quote, mind unleashing game, because basically it was all taking place in your mind. It was going from the miniature wargaming roots of role-playing and then saying, okay, let's do away with the big battle scene and then let's have a dungeon, and of course you could use minis to figure out where you were, but it was all really taking place in your mind. And now we're sort of going away from that and going more into the tactical, or maybe a skirmish. It's more like a series of skirmish, I guess.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that about the first edition of D&D. We're talking boxed edition D&D, by the way, not like first edition Advanced Dungeons & Dragons that had the three books. When that first came out, the combat rules, which were recognizable to role players today, you know, you roll a 20-sided die, if you hit, you inflict so much damage by rolling another die. Those rules were in there, and in the very first book that came out, they recommended, if you're going to do a lot of combat, use the rules for chainmail. Our miniatures rules instead. They're much better for combat. It was AD&D that more or less did away with that whole, you know, you must use minis thing. But the games that really did away with the whole tactile and tactical element and made role-playing more cerebral and more about role-playing was Call of Cthulhu. That was the first one, wasn't it?
Well, like Call of Cthulhu was one of the earlier role-playing games that wasn't really... I mean, when you're playing a horror game, especially if you're basing it on H.P. Lovecraft's work, first of all, you'd have to be completely out of your mind to start making minis of Cthulhu. I mean...
Somebody did.
Yeah, people did, and they were amazing. It's not a game where you can just simply have a combat and saying, okay, guys, this is where you are, and this is where the oversized non-Euclidean monster is, and and how do you even run a tactical game in a non-Euclidean universe? This doesn't happen. And especially since the whole point of a horror game is you're not supposed to have a direct confrontation with the monsters, because usually they're much meaner and more dangerous. I think most of these games, they were not really lent for combat. And so, of course, you didn't have a lot of combat encounters. I mean, another game that really wasn't meant for combat, even though a lot of the times it sort of ended up that way, was the White Wolf books, you know, the Vampire the Masquerade. I mean, I remember playing games of that, and where you were in a combat, and you ended up with, okay, that's way too many dice to roll, you know? these would take...
Here's your bucket, here's the D10s.
Yeah, these are the D10s, and if you're playing the earlier version, and of course, the stronger you are, the more likely you are to botch, and so on. But, I mean... There was something
else. They fixed that, though.
They did fix that, but there was something about the earlier games where it wasn't just minis. It wasn't just like, you know, okay, you have a feeling a lot of right now, and it's kind of weird, too. We went from like having box set to having like just empty books with no and buy your dice somewhere else, or you already have dice. And now we're going back to more boxes or sets where you have, it's more like we're looking at board games.
Yeah, well, okay, what you're really thinking about here is the third edition of Warhammer Fantasy Roleplaying that's going to be put out by Fantasy Flight Games next year, year 2010, that was announced at Gen Con in 2009, August 2009, right?
Yeah, just in August 2009, and Fantasy Flight Game, of course, they're known for making lots of really big board games.
And when we say big, we are talking boxes that you need two arms to carry.
Yes, we mean Descent into Madness.
Well, I'm thinking more like Twilight Imperium or StarCraft or Tannhauser, but sure.
Yeah, so, I mean, they're big games. Like, Descent was, like, a really big fantasy game, too, that you had lots of dice and things. And from what we're seeing or hearing, and it's not really quite sure what form the new Warhammer edition is going to take. And, by the way, there was a new version of Warhammer that was just released not so long ago. Maybe you can tell us about that.
Warhammer Fantasy Role-Playing is one of the many role-playing lines licensed by Games Workshop to Fantasy Flight Games. Last year, like in at Gen Con 2008, there was a release of Warhammer 40K 5th edition. But the new edition of Warhammer Fantasy role-playing game that has been announced by Fantasy Flight Games and was announced by them at Gen Con this year is taking on a very interesting form. They say that it is going to be a box set that is going to retail for $99. I kid you not.
$99. I mean, you used to be able to buy a role-playing... I mean, even the Dungeons & Dragons 4 Fed books, all three of them didn't cost you that much.
$60 if you buy them on Amazon. The D&D 4th Ed books are no longer available on PDF, at least not legally. We're not going to go in the middle of that debate right now. Yeah, it's a $99 boxed set that contains 6 books.
Or will contain 6 books. I'm not quite sure what...
We're future perfect, that's true. That will contain 6 books, several decks of cards, apparently 300 cards total, character-holding boxes or something like that.
And we're not quite sure what these character-holding boxes are. I mean, it's kind of not very clear. Is it going to be like you're going to have like a character card that you just put in the slot? Like, you know, like... How is that going to work?
It's very hard because all we know about it right now is what we got from a press release, which is on Fantasy Flight's website and has been repeated in other areas. So we don't really know what these things are supposed to do. It's also going to contain 30 custom dice.
Yeah, so it's not going to be like...
And hundreds of tokens.
So a lot of people, when they saw this, and I think we've looked at the...
comments
at
on
the
their
comments
website?
On these sites, and of course on forums. A lot of people are saying from what, without even seeing the game, they're saying it's like they have this defeatist attitude. Warhammer is over, oh, I'm going to miss the game. It's like,
or saying, bring, make more second edition books, I don't want to see this.
Yeah, the second edition books, which didn't last that long. I mean, it was, here you guys, here's the new Warhammer second edition, and oh, and by the way, it's not coming out anymore, and here's this box set, we're not quite sure what it's going to be in. There's going to be lots of cool stuff in there, and we know the production value is going to be amazing.
Yeah, yeah. Fantasy Flight makes really, really good products.
I mean, there's stuff. There's going to be tons of stuff in there. It's going to be glossy. It's going to be amazing. It's going to be. But is it going to be Warhammer? And I think that's what a lot of people are complaining about.
Is it going to be Warhammer Fantasy role-playing? Remember, when most people think Warhammer, they think 28mm minis in massive battles.
Yeah, and the other thing we're seeing is, are people wondering, is this going to be on our Warhammer Quest, or Advanced Hero Quest, or Hero Quest, or Battlemaster?
You mean like all the board games that were put out by Games Workshop back when they made board games?
Well, board games, Games Workshop, Milton Bradley, and all these various Warhammer-inspired sort of board games, but it was just like hack and slash, but and minis, and they were interesting, but they weren't role-playing games by any standards. I mean, it was basically just a glorified board game.
Yeah, I need to point out, again, for the benefit of our listeners, that this new product in this $99 box set is being marketed by Fantasy Flight Games as the Warhammer Fantasy role-playing game, not as the Warhammer Fantasy board or card game. Yet it contains all these things that we just described.
Yeah, which is what makes it weird. And the other thing is, too, from reading their press release, and then anybody who listens to this podcast can go and check it out if it's still there.
Well, it's definitely there, and it's also in a recent issue of Polyglot, our game industry newsletter, which is available for free from us.
Okay, so, I mean, the other thing is they're saying that they're going to be reimagining a role-playing game. There's this notion that they're going to be doing something new with role-playing that's going to just turn it on its head. It's going to be brand new. It's going to be like role-playing that no one has ever seen it before, and that's kind of scary. The gaming world is still dealing with the fact that the people that have brought many of the role-playing games and the old veterans who have created this, like Gary Gygax, Dave Arneson, Eric Wujek, and I'm just naming a few here, who are slowly passing away. And now we've got these people coming in. All right, well, it's the new version. It's like it's a Generation X or Y of role-playing games. And a lot of maybe the old-timers are thinking, well, is the hobby really changing? Are we, like, out there? I mean, hell, what about us? You know, are we dinosaurs looking at this thing? And we're just saying, oh, back in the days, we used to play role-playing games with dice, and it just came in books, and now there's these cards. Are we getting cranky, or is there something more sinister happening, or maybe it's just going the right direction? Who knows? I mean, there's a lot of speculation out there.
There are many possible explanations to this, I think. First, there's the need to bring new people into the market. People are attracted to bright, shiny things. They like looking at miniatures. They like looking at boards or cards. They like things that they can touch. The tactile experience of gaming is pleasurable.
That's a bright, shiny thing you've got there, Smeagol. Give it. It's my birthday.
Okay, exactly. Exactly. And you realize what happened to Smeagol and what that bright, shiny thing did to people should tell you what our opinion about this is. But seriously, it's a good thing if you can make physical objects rather than just books, things that could be scanned and uploaded as a torrent, so people can download them as illegal PDFs. That's a better business model for obvious reasons.
So maybe one of the things that people are trying to do with making all these complicated publishing things with 3 or 4 different books, or 6 different books in this case, cards and dice, like, okay, you want to play this game, well, if you want to scan it all or get a legal website as a PDF and try to, it's going to be very difficult. Maybe that's one thing, I don't know, or maybe the whole issue of, too, like going back to D&D 4th Ed, like, oh, it's all minis-based. Okay, sure, maybe you got the pirated software, but, hey, you still have to buy the plastic minis. You can't download plastic minis, last time I checked.
Not yet. Hopefully somebody's working on that. That would be kind of cool if I can just download minis, but legally, of course.
Yeah, we're not like those guys in where is it, Norway? Like in the
Sweden.
Gulag, in Sweden, in the Gulag somewhere, playing, you know, pirated D&D or something.
Moving right along. Well, what we're saying here is that it's very likely that they're trying to first attract a new generation of people who like to look at objects and make objects as part of the gaming experience and not do it completely in the mind. You've got to draw them into the role-playing by, you know, the mental aspect of it, by giving them something they can touch. They also feel that maybe, just maybe, that role-playing games as books that you buy, you know, and play with dice that you buy separately, with character sheets that you scribble out on index paper or whatever, are a thing of the past. And if the hobby is going to reach a new audience, they got to reinvent it.
I mean, isn't it kind of like what they tried to do with Milton Bradley? Came out with a Hero Quest, which was basically Warhammer fantasy, but made as a board game. And it was Games Workshop who worked out with them, I believe. And that was just basically trying to get this new audience. And I'm not sure if... I know maybe some of the listeners probably have played that game. Maybe that was their introduction. But who knows? I mean, is it really going to draw some new people in? Obviously, I mean, the logic is makes sense. You know, hey, guys, let's play this board game. It sounds a lot better than, hey, guys, let's play this game. There's no board, really. No, and you play with these dice. And at first you have to read this book, and guys, where are you, you know? So you maybe that's what it is. Maybe they're trying to open it up to new people.
Well, if that's the case, then they're missing the point about how most people get latched into role-playing games.
Hey, I feel like trying this new thing. Let's spend $100 on this box.
Well, that's one thing, but, like, you know, that's a good point. But what I'm thinking here is that just about anybody will tell you they got started in role-playing because a friend introduced it to them. You know, it's a friend who knew the rules, who already knew these really strange concepts. No, there's no board. You imagine the action. You are pretending to be another person. This is a person. He doesn't have a character. He's called the Game Master. He does something totally different. Trying to explain that to a non-gamer, you know that that's like pulling teeth. But basically everybody who ever got into RPGs got into it because somebody introduced them to it. Nobody spontaneously went out and said, hi, I want to be a role player. Let me buy the books and learn it myself, which is what you can do with a board game.
Yeah, I guess. Well, the fact is, we don't know exactly where this new Warhammer fantasy role-playing game is going.
Because we're not going to see anything until 2010, until I believe fall or early winter of 2010 when they say it's going to be released.
Do they expect a Gen Con release, or is this going to be before Gen Con?
They did say fall or early winter 2010, which means it will be out well in advance of Gen Con. In fact, well in advance of the Gamma Trade Show in April.
Okay, so basically, but probably not in time for Christmas holidays and that sort of thing.
Well, it'll definitely be out before then if they stick to the schedule that they say they are.
So, anyway, so it's kind of like a big question out there. It's a big question mark. But obviously, there might be a silver lining in all of this, and I guess it's, for lack of a better term, the indie movement. All the independent games out there, people are saying, well, let's make new role-playing games, more different things, but it's still using sort of the good old format of there's an RPG book, we assume you already have dice, and if you don't, you're probably not the right person to read this book. And considering some of the indie games out there, probably you shouldn't start role-playing with some of them. I mean, some of them are pretty bizarre.
Yeah, but a lot of them are also very simple, too.
Yeah, but...
And some of them are meant to be played with children, too. I mean, you it's like anything else. You choose wisely.
Yeah, you choose wisely, but there seems to be a lot of them, and I guess, you know, with the PDF industry or whatever, or people even now, it's easy for people to start publishing their own books. I guess, are they filling a new void, and sort of like the bigger companies are making these board RPGs, and now they're making the, you know, the good old-fashioned RPGs? Is that what's happening, or is that...
Well, it is notable that, like, the biggest manufacturers out there, you know, there are roughly six companies, actually now only five companies in the hobby game industry that individually have the power on their own to affect the industry as a whole with a release. Those would be Wizards of the Coast, White Wolf, Games Workshop, Privateer Press, and there used to be WizKids in there, so it's actually five, but now four. Oh, yeah, I forgot Upper Deck Entertainment. You know, you'll notice in that list, most of those companies don't make RPGs.
Yeah, and actually...
And those that do, it's secondary. I mean, you might not realize this. You think Wizards of the Coast, you think D&D. No, what pays everybody's salary at Wizards of the Coast is Magic the Gathering.
Well, and the other thing, too, I guess another company that's similar to this, I mean, when you looked at the people who used to make the big RPGs out there, Steve Jackson Games, for instance, with GURPS, they did have GURPS 3rd edition out, but they're
now
big,
fourth.
Now fourth, and Steve Jackson has said it several times, I mean, what pays his bill is Munchkin.
Yeah.
And Rollmaster is still out there, is still hanging in there. Palladium, what's happening with it? I mean,
they're still putting out books. They're still making stuff. Point is that with even the bigger companies stepping away from RPGs somewhat, like White Wolf aren't. They put out Geist this past year. So that's out there. They are, like, with the RPGs becoming more tactile and less traditional, as was somewhat the case with D&D 4th Ed, and as is definitely the case with Warhammer Fantasy 3rd Edition, the announced Warhammer Fantasy 3rd Edition. The field is being opened up for more companies who have good ideas for traditional RPGs, you know, a book that you buy, and we assume that you know what dice are. The field is open for them to do excellent work. And a very good example was the Origins Awards this past year.
That is very interesting, actually, because a lot of people might have expected, because for years after years, the makers of D&D, for lack of a better term, from TSR to Wizards of the Coast and all the various editions of D&D, I've always somehow, at one point or another, won awards. But this year was slightly different. It was a totally unexpected winner.
Yeah, D&D 4th Ed was nominated for Best RPG Origins Award, but the award went to Mouse Guard, an indie RPG.
And I guess it could be just because of the way that the award, the people voting on the awards, maybe just a lot of people who are upset with 4th Ed, they haven't come to terms that they're essentially saying, okay, bye-bye 3.5, here comes 4th. Maybe that could be that, or maybe there is something a little bit...
I don't think it was backlash. I think it's very interesting how the Origins Awards system works. Companies self-nominate their products into various categories by sending 6 copies to the Game Manufacturers Association, GAMA. They are given out to committees of judges who decide, you know, what the long list is going to be. The short list is made by retailers who vote on them at the GAMA trade show, which is generally in either late March or early April of every year. And then the voting on who actually wins the award is done by attendees, fans in other words, at the Origins Game Fair, which is generally late June, early July of every year.
And Mozgard is, if I'm reading this correctly, is basically a role-playing game and you're playing mice?
Yep.
I mean, it's
as indie as you get.
I mean, this is just like, you know, amazing. I mean,
it's amazing that it beat D&D 4th Ed. Whatever the criteria used for voting is, that Mouse Guard deserves very high praise for unseating, for revealing the elephant in the room here, is that the fact of the matter is people who like role-playing games want their role-playing games to be role-playing games and not minis games or board games.
Now, going back to a more traditional game, and I guess we could say it's continuation of the open gaming license, D20, the gaming system was set up when the OGL came out, and the open gaming phenomenon happened with the D&D 3rd Ed in the early 2000s. Now there is a new version of this OGL, Fantasy for Fantasy Lovers, called Fantasy Craft, made up by Crafty Games, the makers of Spycraft. And it was released just recently, and at the beginning of August.
At Gen Con 2009.
Gen Con 2009. We have a view copy that we're now going to be looking at and discussing. And maybe you can tell us, like, I mean, for a lot of people out there, what would you say makes Fantasy Craft different from, say, another version of, you know, Dungeons & Dragons 3.5? Like, what would make it different from, say, Pathfinder? We'll go into a review of Fantasy Craft, but after this.
Okay, Mags, you know about the reviews, interviews, news, and discussions that we have here on All Games Considered. But before you join up, we should tell you about the curse.
Wait, what?
Yeah, what's this about?
The co-host curse. I mean, you know, first there was just Mike and his bizarre gardening accident. Poor
bizarre
guy.
Bizarre gardening.
And then there was the first Chris. He choked on...
Mark, what does this have to do with anything?
Well, you guys are going through co-host at an alarming rate.
And it's not going to get better if Mark keeps scaring them away.
All Games Considered, featuring news and conversations about all aspects of tabletop gaming, is a proud member of Goblin, the gaming broadcast network.
Start your journey at www.agcpodcast.info.
Let me guess, the second Chris spontaneously combusted during a recording, right?
Yeah, how did you know?
Welcome back. So here we are discussing the new Fantasy Craft, and for a lot of people out there, it's a new version of the Open Gaming License, a fantasy game. There's a few things that were different. I mean, it's using the it's made out by Crafty Games, the maker of Spycraft, and they made this game the same way that they sort of modified the D20 Modern for making their Spycraft game, and then they sort of applied it to Fantasy Craft. And first of all, I guess to a lot of people out there, what makes this game different from, like, let's say, another Dungeons and Dragons?
Okay. One first thing, like, it is indeed Crafty Games' own version of the D20 system that they actually call the Mastercraft system, which...
As a Mastercraft item?
No, they call it the Mastercraft system. I don't know why they call it that. But there is a strong emphasis on individual options and plug-in and play options here also, like various ways that you could craft, there's just no other word, the entire game system, the gaming experience to suit your own way. This is not D&D, like straight D&D 3.5, you know, ironed out and fixed so that it would be better, so you can play it the way you used to play it, only better, which is essentially what Pathfinder is. This is qualitatively a different game. Like when Spycraft 2.0 came out a couple of years ago, everybody was saying, and I think this is correct, it's a better D20 Modern than D20 Modern. Well, this could really be said it's a better D&D than D&D. First of all, they gave you many options that were unheard of in D&D as far as character races are concerned. You could be, you know, there are the humans, there are halflings, they don't call them that, they call them something else, which is interesting.
What do they call them?
Yeah, they're called pecks. I don't know why, but they're called pecks, not halflings, but they're essentially halflings. You could be an ogre. Now, they have a totally different set of races. Of course, they've got dwarves, elves, humans, they've got pecks, which are basically halflings by another name. You could also be a giant, a goblin, an ogre, or a saurian. They also have something called a root walker, which is basically a treant by any other name. So they're clearly like trying to give you different options here that are actually fantastic in a way. They're not only do you have character classes, but there are various character human talents and human qualities there, which give you a whole bunch of different ability score modifications, feats, and so on, that essentially describe, like, just to give you an example, if you are cunning, you have, like, +2 to dexterity, -2 to charisma, higher base speed, you have the feat charming, cheap shot, sharp mind, and tenacious spirit. And these are all together, just for choosing one talent of being cunning, that is. They have several specialties.
And the specialties are interesting. For, I think a lot of people who like D&D 2nd Ed with all the various types of classes and subclasses and all these from fence to chivalrous fighters, I think they're going back to that. Is that my impression?
Yeah, your impression is correct. I mean, you could be forgiven for looking at these specialties and thinking that these are actually character classes, because they're so specific in nature about like the kind of character that you are. But as a matter of fact, these are lenses, if you will, that you can apply to the actual character classes, which are, which include your basics, you know, fighters, assassins, burglars, that's what they call thieves, and so on and so forth. And, you know, there are prestige classes available, though they're not called prestige classes, they're called master classes, which suits the Mastercraft system. There's the rules are different. They include action dice, which are sort of like drama dice. They're bonus dice, in other words, which can be used in various ways to boost your experience. They have certain rules in here that are familiar from D20. I mean, if you have played D&D before, you'll recognize most of this, and you will be able to play it. You'll just need to learn some newer things here. This is not reinventing the wheel. They're reinventing the entire engine, quite frankly, with Fantasy Craft. They have a different approach to equipment, where you buy equipment, not necessarily individual pieces of equipment, but entire kits.
Okay.
Entire loadouts all at once. They also have a different approach to magic items, which is something that they did in Spycraft in their own way, which was you create a quality that the item has, then the form that the item takes, and then that's what the item is. Like, for instance, powerful plus a shield is a magic shield, whereas with a sword or a ring, it's a totally different thing. And it's this approach that basically means you can make just about any kind of item. They don't exhaust you with a laundry list of magic items in there, but just with very detailed rules about how you can make any kind of magic item you could possibly want.
Now, the other thing too that's interesting is that this book is kind of like the Player's Handbook and the Dungeon Master's Handbook. What is the Dungeon Master called in Fantasy Craft? The Fantasy Master?
It's called the Game Controller, the GC, just like in Spycraft.
Okay.
It's actually the PHB, the DMG, and the Monster Manual all rolled into one big honking 400-page volume.
It is a honking volume. It is 400 pages.
You think you're going to get a sore arm from holding it with one hand.
It is 400 pages, hardcover, good quality. The artwork is cool.
But it's less slick. It's more organic looking. It's fantasy.
I would say if people are looking for something, it's kind of like a mix with the Dungeons & Dragons 3rd edition artwork and the White Wolf sort of black and white stylish artwork rolled into one. I guess that's probably the way of doing it.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
The font is a little hard to read, but I guess it's similar to the, as in the font is easy to read, but it is smaller, which just means it's 400-page book at is in small font. I mean, there is a lot of dense material out there. I mean, yeah, it's not something...
Also, it goes with Crafty Games' ethos that a game's core book should be referred to and not read. I would really be scared if I met somebody who read this from cover to cover who didn't already work for Crafty Games.
Another thing, too, I've noticed here in the book is that they, unlike maybe some of the other books where, because a lot of people, from what we've said, might think that this is just a book that has just rules. I mean, there is no game setting. There isn't a tied game setting yet. It's really just the rules stuff, but there is some stuff on how to actually run a GM here, and they're actually giving you some...
And world-building rules.
And world-bendings, and they're giving you some pointers on how to make cinematic-style combat with cutscenes and changing and shifting perspective from players and so on. It's very interesting. It's not something you play with meetings like what we discussed earlier, remember, in the podcast.
Oh, you sure could, but it isn't necessary. It isn't obligatory.
You can actually... you know, maybe see the fight in your head as you're playing it. And that's, I think, is going back to what maybe gaming was about.
Oh, that's to the more cerebral level of role-playing that it developed into in the 80s, and which made the hobby mature.
Now, anybody who wants to pick up this game, is it going to be like an easy game to pick up if you've played other crafty games before? Is it going to be intuitively, or is this like a really different game?
If you've played Spycraft, you'll be able to sink your teeth into this very, very quickly. Because the Mastercraft system is represented there well. Now, like you did say, there is no setting built into it yet. Not like I'd really be interested to see if and when Crafty Games makes some kind of default setting for Fantasycraft, just like they did for Spycraft with the World on Fire source book, which was basically a setting book that allowed for any kind of espionage role-playing in a world that was completely blasted to hell by a series of unfortunate events. As for Fantasycraft so far, it's basically could be summarized by their advertising slogan, "Your dungeon, your dragon, your way." If you've played other forms of D20 before, you are going to have to note how character generation is different, because this isn't your basic run-of-the-mill D&D clone. You're going to have to relearn combat as well, because combat is handled differently and, compared with other D20 games I've seen around there, way better.
Now, we've said there's a lot of good things about Fantasycraft, and if we had to say what would be some of the drawbacks of the game, obviously this is not the game that if you're a beginner you're going to find it easy to get into role-playing. It's not a beginner's game, I guess. It's more for seasoned veterans.
This is definitely for seasoned veterans. This is for experienced role-players who really know what they're doing and also know what they want to do. The rules are complicated. There's no question about that. The other thing is that the word craft in there is important. A large onus is placed on the game controller, the GC, to do everything, to make up everything. It is very, very do-it-yourself.
I mean, the slogan says it all. I mean, your dungeon, your way.
There is a huge onus put on the game controller. If you're not the type of person who likes to create everything in minutia, then this game might not be for you.
Obviously, there's a lot of work that the game controller has to do in order to run Fantasycraft. I mean, they're in the book itself. I mean, there is no setting, so if you're just picking that right now and you want to start playing it, you either have to create your own setting or use another game setting that's out there adapted to it. So there's work there.
There's no setting in this book. You have to make your own setting or use something that's already available off the shelf, I suppose. Other thing is that because the rules are so dense that it actually takes a lot out of the game controller's hands and put it into the hands of the players. The game controller effectively is someone who's just controlling the action, but is not an active participant in the game past that point.
Now, and I know there's a lot of information in that book, but is there a lot of monsters being described, or is that also left out?
It isn't a huge bestiary. It's not. There's no. You're not going to find the monster manual in here, that's for sure. Yes, there are pre-statted monsters in there that you can use, but there are not a lot of them. That's another thing that's left to the game controller, really, is to make new monsters.
Or, obviously, yeah, they'll come up with more supplements with it, but as it is, it's more of a, I guess we could call it a core book, if you will. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it is either you get creative from the get-go and make your own monsters or and adventures, or you're going to have to wait for the next supplements to come out. But obviously, that book, as a standalone product, is as good as it is. It can be a little bit time intensive and a little bit difficult or tricky to actually start using to create a game, I guess.
Yeah, now, see, that's its greatest strength and also its greatest drawback. It all depends on what your interests are. If you like to take the time to make your D20 fantasy gaming experience exactly as you like it, you know, without having to house rule everything, but to work with a toolbox rather than just take something ready off the shelf, then Fantasy Craft is right for you. If, on the other hand, you want something that's ready-made so that you can play now and so that you could teach the noobs very quickly, this might not be for you.
I mean, unless you're using pre-generated characters. And speaking of character generation, we touched about this. I mean, it's interesting that you have a lot of interesting races, but I'm sure everybody knows that a Pex, that's what they call the halflings there, isn't necessarily going to be walking around with a giant and or a lizard person. Like, how do these races get together? I mean, it's not... there's a lot of room there. If people create characters from all these walks of life, it might be difficult for the Game Master to make a Korean game world out of it. Or make a Korean campaign out of it. How did this pretty coalesce into one unit, you know?
That's a problem with a lot of games. They give you a lot of options at character generation.
Yeah, so, I mean, the Game Master has to sort of step down and say, no, in my world, you can only be these types of characters if I want to make a first game.
About character generation, you need to know your players before springing Fantasy Craft on them. There are so many options in there that if you have, like, the uber munchkins in your group, or the people who can't make up their minds very quickly, they're going to get lost in character generation and try to create the most awesome something, and that's going to be very time consuming, so be wary about that. There are so many different options and so many different combinations possible for character generation that this is basically the D20 version of GURPS. Rules are designed to be used modularly when you're creating, you know, anything from magic items to characters to monsters, because it's based on combining effects with things that produce or contain that effect.
Yeah, so there's a lot of modular, you could, like, they even say it here, you know, you can spend a lot of time with this book before you start playing, and they even suggest that you get together and start playing a mock-up combat, testing out to see if there's any questions cropping up and so on. It's almost sounds like they're telling you, hey guys, go and play test this game, but really, I guess what we're trying to say is that the rules are complex. There's so many complication maneuvers and things that you can mix and match that you might actually get lost initially. You have to sort of like practice before you actually learn the game. I think there's so much choices and so much complication. And you've said it before, it's a very complex game. You can do a lot of things, but then at the same time, that could actually be a problem with this game. It's not going to be something you just pick up and play. It might actually be very difficult to actually master the Mastercraft system.
Yeah, no, I'll say it again. It's a great game for experienced role players who really, really know what they want and to have a lot of patience to learn something complex. It's not a game for noobs or for people who want something that's quick and dirty.
So that sums up our review of Fantasy Craft. Definitely, it is a good quality book. Obviously, if you're a new player, it might be a little bit dense for you to actually use, and even the experienced players might find it complicated unless you have some experience with the Mastercraft system. Obviously, they will be coming out with more books with settings and so on, but obviously, just by this book alone, it might be a little bit difficult for you to actually start playing a game. But having said that, it does look like it is a worthy successor of the OGL. Obviously, they've taken a new twist on it, and they've added some interesting things for GMs as well.
On the other hand, if you want your fantasy gaming to still be in the D20 paradigm and to be exactly the way you want it, and not to be like the D&D that you're used to, then this is definitely worth looking at.
If you liked this show, come on over to rpgpodcasts.com. where you'll find dozens more great role-playing podcasts.
So this wraps up this episode of Dicecast. We started off with a discussion of role-playing games and where role-playing games are going by discussing the various incarnations of Dungeons & Dragons and the way that role-playing games seems to be evolving with the new Warhammer game that has been announced and the various types of gaming aspects that from board games to role-playing game proper. And we've selected one new game that was out there the fantasy craft, which was interesting to us because it's a new take on fantasy and also a little bit different from the Dungeons & Dragons games that everyone else has been talking about recently. I guess you can stay tuned for more amazing content like this one, and you can always come find our podcast at our website.
Polymancer Studios is pleased to announce the release of its new generic role-playing rules set entitled Open 6. To find out more about Open 6, please visit our website, www.polymancer.com, and then follow the links.
Well, that's all the time we have for this segment. You can find out more about who we are and what we do at our website, www.polymancer.com. The music for this segment, Fort Minor, Remember the Name, BYFH Remix by Chojin, Industrial March Beat by Neurowax, Triple Layer Guitar in E by Neurowax, Violated Instrumental by Technetium, are all released under the Creative Commons license. This episode is copyright 2009 Polymancer Studios Incorporated, released under the Creative Commons and Attribution No Derivative Works License 3.0, available at creativecommons.org. Dicecast is a trademark of Polymancer Studios Incorporated. The word Polymancer is a registered trademark of Polymancer Studios Incorporated. Thank you for listening to the Dicecast.